Hi, this is Phil Taylor, host of CIUT Friday Morning. Every Friday morning between 9 a.m. and 10 a.m., we have film reviews and interviews by Daniel Garber, our film critic, theater reviews and interviews by Lynn Slotkin, our theater critic and passionate playgoer, and a deeper look at classical music by Philip Conlon. We also discuss the headlines affecting our world. CIUT Friday Morning, we give voice to radio that matters to you. CIUT 89.5 FM, the new sound of your city.
Right here, right now, every day. CIUT 89.5, the sound of your city.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. And Phil Conlon is tardy, but we're not going to mark him down. We're going to talk today about the developments in Aleppo in Syria. We're going to get updated, we hope, on a number of questions that are not being dealt with in our major newspapers. Actually, I checked the Star today. Apparently, Aleppo isn't happening. At least I couldn't find any articles. Actually, a major confrontation of sorts is taking place, with the United States announcing that they're not going to talk anymore or have bilateral relations with Russia. Because of the falling out over this matter. And we will also, we hope to be talking to spokesperson for the Women's Boat to Gaza. Go to their website, Freedom Flotilla or Women's Boat to Gaza. Go to Women's Boat to Gaza. There is a Twitter report so that you can be absolutely updated to the last minute. I can tell you, for example, one of the things I learned is one of the boats is broken down in Messina. And it is not going to be on the voyage, so there will be the one boat, the Zaytuna, is on its way towards Gaza as we speak. Again, it is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM, and I think we are joined by Mr. Rick Sterling. Are you there, sir?
Yeah, hi, Phil.
It's good to be talking to you, Rick, because, of course, there's a lot of developments, and I'm not able to get much information from my daily paper. You know that newspapers still exist. I know that you've written on a number of angles, but the one that interests me most and it surprises me in terms of coverage is that since the end of the ceasefire, there has been a lot of activity on the ground between the rival forces, with considerable success apparently being registered by the Syrian army, though all I read in the Star, Toronto Star, Globe and Mail, New York Times, is that the entire Russian Air Force and the entire Syrian Air Force are trying to find hospitals to bomb. That seems to be their version of the military developments. Can you tell me, I'm sure you have better sources than I do, what does it look like to you in terms of the military side in that area?
The reports coming out indicate there are advances, definitely, but the collapse of all the terrorist groups in East Aleppo, that has not happened. Mm-hmm. It's almost building by building fighting, urban fighting. Basically the Al Kindi Hospital, which is it was the pride and joy of Syria, that has been held by the terrorists for a couple of years now. They basically detonated a monstrous truck bomb at the entryway to it, and then they executed and video recorded the execution of the soldiers that were captured there. That's under the control of the Syrian army now, and that's apparently quite solid. And the Palestinian camp known as Handarat, that's completely controlled by the Syrian forces now. And they're pushing further into East Aleppo. Now, you hear different estimates of the number of people who are living in East Aleppo. Some people say 200,000, 250,000. It's curious, and I think it's definitely uncertain, because Martin Chulov, who writes for The Guardian out of London, he visited there in 2014, and his estimate was 40,000 in the whole, in all of the opposition-held neighborhoods in East Aleppo. So it's really unclear. What we do know is that the vast majority of people, 1.5 million, are in western Aleppo under protection of the Syrian government, mm-hmm. where things operate, you know, semi-normally. They have actually the water supply is actually controlled from the opposition-held zone, so they lose water, they lose electricity periodically, and it's grim. But life goes on there, and there's a lot of civilians living in mm-hmm. West Aleppo. Mm-hmm. In East Aleppo, there's and the reports in the paper today about the so-called cave hospital. The headlines in the New York Times was something like, "Even in a bunker under a mountain, the Syrian hospital." Is attacked by airstrikes. Mm-hmm. Basically, it's nonsense and propaganda. The Syrians and with their Russian allies, they want to. They're attacking terrorists, mm-hmm. the people who are launching shells into Western Aleppo and killing people every day. They're attacking the groups that are committed to overthrowing the Syrian government. They have no reason to be attacking hospitals. And so I think you know, militarily things are moving ahead. There's kind of a hysteria in the Western media now because the regime change project it may collapse. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the real reason behind the kind of storm of propaganda around Syria right now.
Yeah, it's as though they're rearranging their strategy.
Yes, and that one's played well in the past, and it also kind of aligns with all the publicity and propaganda around the so-called white helmets.
Mm-hmm.
That's a propaganda strategy that they see it works. Now, in April, there was a huge amount of publicity, and that was after the collapse of the February cessation of hostilities. There was a lot of publicity around what was called the Al-Quds Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And Doctors Without Borders, MSF, they were in the forefront. They said this was the hospital they supported, and you had MSF officials in Europe speaking about it. Well, I did an investigation of that, which resulted in an open letter to Dr. Joanne Liu, who's the head of their international, international organization. She's Canadian, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And, I wrote a respectful letter to her, but I identified all sorts of contradictions and inconsistencies in their report. Number one, the photograph, it was unclear from the photograph where there was any damage. It was basically a sandbagged building that looked like an apartment complex. It was not identified as a hospital. Mm-hmm. There was a destroyed vehicle in front, but that looked like it might have occurred in a battle, who knows, the year before.
Mm-hmm.
They could not identify. There were some reports of 15 people killed. Some reports said 50 killed. And they basically had no corroborating information, and they had basically reported what somebody had told them.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very flimsy evidence.
Uh-huh. And I take it you got no satisfactory explanation of the contradictions or the... Yeah.
That is correct. they did phone me up. I had a lengthy phone conversation with one of their top officers from Europe. He made me swear not to write anything about our conversation, which, I agreed with. I said, if I'm going to write something, I'll tell you, but... They basically have not provided the backup information that was requested in my letter, and I plan to write them again because we're seeing this as a repeating theme. Mm-hmm. Well, one thing about it
go on.
Is that the opposition should identify hospitals. And then, because the Russians and the Syrians both say they do not attack hospitals. Mm-hmm. So if the opposition identifies and clearly marks a hospital, that would be an area that the Russians and Syrians would not target.
Yeah. Well, by the way, can I ask you that? Did they ever claim that they had marked them? And did they say, oh, we warned them? I remember when U.S. hit the MSF hospital in Afghanistan, one of the shocking details was that the U.S. had been told over and over where it was, and then it got hit.
Exactly.
So
and
did these people claim?
Identified. The one in East Aleppo, the so-called Al-Quds hospital, I mean, there's no comparison. I looked to the the one in Kunduz is a very well-identified hospital. It's a well-known hospital, whereas the one in East Aleppo, nobody had ever heard of it before. Basically, it was not what we think of as a hospital. It might have been a clinic in the ground floor of an apartment building. Who knows?
Yes. By the way, one of the things that irritates me when I follow this is that there are no protocols that these gentlemen, like the White Helmets and the this weird collection of very violent groups, they don't go by the rules of saying this is a hospital. We don't have soldiers there, because that's always a question. And in order not to be hit, you have to, both sides have to play by the rules. It has to be marked, and it has to be clear that nobody's putting ammunition or guns.
Yes.
And we're not getting any. I have seen no assurances from the combatants of East Aleppo. Mm-hmm. Of any of that. They don't even seem to be interested in that. They don't seem to think they have to play by any kind of rules at all. And Washington and Britain and others indulge that kind of craziness.
Well, exactly. There's a mountain of deception going on, and where the United States says that they accept that that Nusra Front is a terrorist group. It's the Al-Qaeda-associated group inside Syria. The U.S. says that they recognize it as terrorist, but there's increasing evidence that the U.S. has been directly and indirectly supplying them with weapons. Mm-hmm. In fact, there was an interview by a German journalist, Jürgen Todenhofer, just a week ago, where he did a face-to-face interview with a Nusra leader, and that's what the Nusra said. Oh, yes, we're getting weapons from the U.S.
Yes.
We'd like more.
And the State Department doesn't comment on his remarks.
They've been asked about it, and they basically avoid it. They have admitted, however, that they have not, that they've never attacked Nusra. Mm-hmm. The U.S. air coalition that's flying over Syria without Syrian permission, by the way, they have attacked ISIS, but they've never attacked Nusra.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking to Rick Sterling. I just put his name in the net, and you will find many excellent articles, particularly on these issues of the White Helmets and the identification of the armed groups. Just a little detail about the fighting. There's something called the Costello Road that seems to be under the government control, and there is news of another road with the word the Rusif Roundabout, which may have fallen to the government today or yesterday. Can you tell us what are those? The one I just mentioned, the roundabout, that's in the southwest, is it not? In that in the area where the last attempt at a breakout was.
I'm not sure. I'd have to look back through my notes. Some of the Arabic names or the translations don't stick in my mind, but that may be in the south, where basically the Syrian army captured it 2 or 3 weeks ago, and then it was retaken back. Then there was a cessation of hostilities, and then the armed opposition mounted a huge offensive. Mm-hmm. Basically, they brought in fighters from Idlib province, which is to the south.
Yes, by the way, taking advantage of the ceasefire.
Exactly, and resupplied weaponry, and they did a huge assault, and they captured a military base as well. Mm-hmm. And the Syrian army was they were basically overwhelmed and retreated, but they have recaptured that since then.
Mm-hmm. Well, now that is also a very important thing that is being missed by the Western media. They assiduously avoid this kind of thing, but there. For example, now we're getting these very loud noises, UN asking for a ceasefire because bad things are happening. Mm-hmm. Lavrov, who represents the Russian point of view, said that, he said, you know, they asked us, here we are, we're closing the encircling the terrorists. And then they say, well, we bad things are happening, we'd like a three-day ceasefire. And he said, well, we thought that was reasonable. Then we gave the next day they tell us, they want 7 days.
Right.
So, you know, and then after that, they get attacked by. And so,
yeah.
You know, this business of being nice about this is getting more and
right.
more frustrating. Incidentally, it leads to the loss of life of Syrian soldiers and puts everybody at risk while this kind of cynicism plays out.
Right.
Where we are now. It appears that certainly the government of Assad, President Assad, has pretty much run out his patience with these kind of games. Oh, by the way, there is a detail that also to add. I noticed that the Russians and Syria today are still saying, quite smartly in my opinion, we give you 48 hours if you will agree to leave, and we won't mm-hmm. harm you.
Right.
You can take your weapons, which,
yeah.
by the way, is classic. Anybody studied the history of warfare and great battles and whatnot, and after the Civil War, you know, Mr.
Yeah.
What was his name? Robert E. Lee was allowed with sidearms, but
mm-hmm.
they had to say it's over and go home or get out of there and say where you're going.
Right.
Now,
right. And actually,
who can argue with that? I mean, that is a very humane. Well,
I'm glad you raised that point because it's rarely mentioned in the Western media that the Syrian government has a ministry of reconciliation. They've had for years now, they've had an active program where they basically encourage, you know, so-called rebels or individuals who were part of a terrorist group to lay down their arms and sign an agreement and rejoin society.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it's basically like that. Other times they simply leave a city and they're allowed or they're actually transported to another part of the country.
Mm-hmm.
So that happened just last week where the last remnant of terrorists who had occupied a part of the city of Homs were basically taken in buses, two buses, I believe, were taken to Idlib, where there's a significant terrorist presence remaining.
Mm-hmm.
So they make these agreements that are basically in the interests of society. Now, the best situation is where the terrorists actually say, okay, you know, I wanted to overthrow the government, I joined the terrorist group, and I'm not going to do it anymore, I realize it was a mistake, let me go on with my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know the details of how they ensure that people are genuine and sincere, but there are many, many cases. In fact, I've been witness to people who had done that in the city of Homs, actually, mm-hmm. where I visited in 2014.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an active program that they've got on. Now, the terrorists who are foreigners, they are not... they are not part of that deal, of course, and they are the ones who refuse to negotiate, the ones who are directly paid by Saudi Arabia, Qatar, France, you know, the
mm-hmm.
Western countries.
Mm-hmm.
The foreigners are never going to accept that, so they have to just leave. But the Syrians, there is an active reconciliation effort that goes out, because at some point Syria is going to have to, hopefully the Syrian army and allies will prevail, continue to have a secular government. They'll have an election, and Assad will be reelected, or somebody else will come in,
mm-hmm.
and they can, you know, hopefully move on. But with hundreds of thousands killed, another thing that the media never talks about is the tremendous death count of Syrian soldiers, which points to the fact that of the modern weaponry, the modern sniping rifles that have been supplied to the terrorists. Over 100,000 Syrian soldiers and militia, National Defense Forces, have been killed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, imagine, you know, imagine if Canada lost 100,000 soldiers and security services.
By the way, that was, I recall President Obama talking about this, and he talked about it with Libya, too. He said, we will degrade them, basically wear them down, destroy their ability to sustain themselves until you basically bleed them to death, you know, by whatever means.
Yeah.
It strikes me that that is sort of what they're hoping to do. They have – the Syrian population has been under immense stress to be attacked by parties unnamed with money unaccounted for and heads of state. Like, well, for example, the Saudis leading a move to remove Syria as an Arab state, which – when in fact it's the motherland of the Arab people.
Yeah.
A bizarre situation. We are speaking to Rick Sterling. I want to ask you – make sure I – clarify this, because your writing and that of Vanessa Beely has been excellent on this subject, and I notice you have everybody nervous because you seem to rely on facts, which bothers them. This phenomena of the white helmets that you alluded to in Syria and certainly in West Aleppo, where, as you point out, the largest population is, there is civil defense organization. It's an old organization. It belongs to international agencies, where they have protocols and rules and constitutions and such.
Yeah.
Then you have, and they're supplying when a building is hit in Aleppo West. Of course, they race and try to help. Now you have this other group, self-created, which, as you pointed out on this program, stole the name of Syria self-defense, civil defense. So why aren't people nominating all of them for a Nobel Prize? Why would you only nominate this self-created phony operation for Nobel Prize?
Well, the reason they got nominated is because they have a slick, very, very well-funded marketing campaign, put simply. They're basically a creation of the media, you know, from the get-go, with funding from the U.S. and the U.K. and the Asfari Foundation. Asfari is a billionaire oil and gas individual who's got this foundation. He's pumped a lot of money in, along with the U.S. And the U.K. They created what they call Syrian Civil Defense, stealing the name, as you mentioned, from the legitimate organization founded in 1953.
Yeah, which continues to function and has more people, right?
Oh yeah, it has way more people. They don't have the resources. They don't have the fancy new equipment and the fancy, you know, the nice white helmets and the uniforms and all that.
But to the White House.
They're the legitimate one, whereas the hoax white helmets is basically it's primarily a political lobbying force. It's a feel-good group. Lots of well-meaning people look at it and say, gee, that sounds good. These are the first responders who are there rescuing people, removing babies. But it's primarily a lobby force. And they've got a ton of marketing behind them, and that's how they were able to get the Right Livelihood Foundation Award, which I've mentioned before.
I'd say the odds are they're going to get that prize, because it would just absolutely dovetail with U.S. foreign policy. I think it's next week they're going to announce it, isn't it?
Well, then they won the Right Livelihood, but it's the Nobel Peace Prize. I'd be very surprised if Nobel went for them, because it's breaking out. The news is getting out. In fact, today on Alternet, Max Blumenthal has an expose on he calls it the shadowy organization behind the white helmets.
Good.
So it's the news is getting out.
So you think the odds are falling on their being nominated?
Oh, I think definitely.
Or winning it.
They're falling. Now, one thing I'll mention to you, which has happened since we last talked, Phil, is that Change.org has removed the petition to not give the Nobel Peace Prize to the White Helmets. Well, that they would, shut it
well,
down.
Well, then, that, as a gambling man, that runs my numbers up on the chances they're going to win.
Well, you're right. They're trying to disappear it. Yes. 3,300 people had signed that
petition. What can we do? Tell us about that petition. Can anybody still sign it? If it's been disappeared, as long as we get Rick Sterling, we should be okay.
If people who are interested could contact change.org and ask, well, what happened to that petition? I wanted to sign it.
Yeah. Why did
they don't make it easy to do that, but if you poke around at their website, the justification they give for this kind of thing is it violates community standards. And we're trying to get a clarification, well, what community standard did that petition violate?
Yeah.
It did was expose the reality very factually. Mm-hmm. About this organization, and it's not even, I don't know if I mentioned to you last time, it's not just that they stole the name Serious Civil Defense, they also stole the name White Helmets. There's an organization, an Argentinian organization called Cascos Blancos White Helmets, mm-hmm. which has been doing international relief work for 22 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm very glad you mentioned that. Again, it's Rick Sterling. Another detail I noticed, and I wonder if you could comment. Another thing they've done that seems to me to should cause the removal from anybody nominating him is they picked a fight with the United Nations and with Red Cross, saying that they didn't want to share information. And the UN response was, it was quoted in The Guardian, this is actually a couple of 3 weeks ago, they said, actually, we work with all parties. We have to. If we're going to save lives, we can't play games with human lives. But this group, which is, you've just described, self-created with a big public relations department, they are actually trying to undermine the work of the UN agency in Damascus and of Red Crescent, two rather well-established entities.
Well, that's right. And that's the difference between a legitimate relief for humanitarian organization and the White Helmets is that a legitimate one actually does work on both sides and is committed to being apolitical. Mm-hmm. Whereas the fake White Helmets only works in the opposition terrorist-controlled zones, primarily the al-Qaeda Nusra area. Mm-hmm. They only work there, and they are very actively political. Mm-hmm. They are part of campaigns to bring a U.S. NATO intervention via a no-fly zone.
Mm-hmm. Yes, they have a war position, which is, again, rather eccentric for somebody who claims that they're interested in saving lives.
Right, and they complain. The fact is two-thirds of the displaced persons from Syria are in Syria. They moved to Latakia, or they moved to Homs or Damascus from Aleppo, or from other zones. When the terrorists took over Idlib province, 90% of the civilians left. They don't want to be controlled by the terrorists. The terrorists are very unpopular in Syria.
Yeah,
they get a lot of money from the West. Canada's in there, too.
Yes. It's traditional.
Following the U.S. Lead. And I think, I mean, a lot of hullabaloo went up about Maher Arar, but I'll tell you who took up a lot more injustice and a lot was done to people like Damien Claremont, mm-hmm. who was allowed to become brainwashed and allowed to join the terrorists, basically, and be killed there. Mm-hmm. And his mother fought courageously to expose what was going on and basically change what was happening in Calgary in a mosque where five young Canadians got recruited to join ISIS or Nusra.
Yes. Every time one of these things happens, the intelligence guys always say, yeah, well, we knew that was going on. We were watching. Yeah, well, you were watching while a young Canadian got killed, brainwashed first and then killed.
Thing. Damien Claremont got his new Canadian passport 2 months before he left.
Yeah.
They knew where he was going, and you bet if he was going to the U.S. to commit terrorism, they would have stopped him.
Yes, yes. We also had the incident at at the Capitol in Ottawa where the young man was he wanted to travel. He was going to go to Saudi Arabia. Nobody had a problem with that, and they knew what he was, but they made no attempt, and he ended up killing a soldier. And of course, we had really scary situation. But you have a comparable thing in the U.S. where people obviously mentally troubled in all this end up being permitted to carry out acts while being monitored. So you have to wonder about what's going on. I want to take you back to a point, though, by the way, where we started in this matter of reporting damage to hospitals. They, the Globe today, I think they said that there were 2,000 bombs had been dropped in a month, and that and that there was deliberate targeting of medical facilities and whatnot. However, they also said one person had been killed, and I thought, so you have 2,000 bombs and one person has died in a hospital.
Mm-hmm.
The data doesn't compute. But the other matter, and I read this at Vanessa Bailey, and I'm sure, I mean, it's just a simple fact, isn't it? Those hospitals are Syrian hospitals. Mm-hmm. They weren't built since the terrorists arrived. They took over hospitals. And we know nothing about what they're doing there. But mm-hmm. why would a country bomb its own hospital?
Right. Well, this has been repeated so many times. It's like the weapons of mass destruction. Well, of course, Saddam he must have weapons of mass destruction. Everybody's been saying it, and they keep saying and repeating the Syrian Air Force is targeting hospitals. Well, how's that true? I mean, what is the evidence of that? The famous case from April I mentioned was an unmarked, nondescript building. Mm-hmm. So how was the Syrian Air Force, if it was actually bombed, because it's actually unclear if or how it was bombed.
Yes.
But, how do they know the Syrian government was targeting a known hospital when it's unmarked?
Yes. Well, this is where we have this. People are commenting in the last 24 hours, both the journalism and the statements from the leaders, particularly the United States, has become fairly irrational, which is probably the most worrying thing. But they also, the articles in which they say hospitals are targeted, they will quote UN leaders or spokespersons saying indiscriminate. Mm-hmm. Well, of course, if you're targeting a hospital, that's not indiscriminate. That's actually discriminate.
I mean, the first
no editor at the paper said, we can't put these two words in the same article.
Right,
To, put it in the back page. We can contradict it, but in the same article? No. I mean, that's why we have editors.
Right. Well, the article that I'm working on right now is titled, Does Syria Have a Right to Defend Itself? And I compare and contrast the situation with Israel, where Israel has bombed Gaza ferociously in 2008, 2010, 2014. In 2014, they killed 2,700 people, 2,700 dead, 97% of them Palestinians. Mm-hmm. And the U.S. says, what's the U.S. response? What's the Canadian response? Well, Israel has a right to defend itself.
Yes.
And if you look at the numbers, over 10 years, the total, lots of little homemade mortars or rockets went out of Gaza into Israel. A grand total of 28 people were killed.
Mm-hmm.
Across 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And yet Israel, in just that one campaign, killed 2,700.
Mm-hmm.
Where you contrast that with the situation, and the Palestinians are basically protesting, and it's almost a symbolic protest, because the rockets that they launch out of there have done so little damage. Mm-hmm. They're protesting their conditions. They're protesting the fact they're basically in a prison camp in Gaza, mm-hmm. and Israel has denied them their rights under mm-hmm. UN Resolution 194 and also under the Geneva Convention.
Yes.
Whereas in Syria, you have a sectarian, you have over 100,000 sectarian rebel terrorists who are hell-bent on overthrowing the government, who have killed over 100,000 Syrian soldiers and militia, and who carry out amazing amount of violence. If you look at the videos of the beheading of a little boy in the back of a pickup truck a few weeks ago, mm-hmm. if you look at the execution of Syrian soldiers in many, many places.
And as a theater of macabre, as at Palmyra, when they bring them out on a Roman theater and make them crouch on their knees for a movie, which is very well put together, well produced, and then cut their throats.
Cut their throats, or they have little kids doing the execution. It's so obscene. Mm-hmm. And yet, have we ever heard Canada or the United States say that the Syrian government has a right to defend itself?
No.
No. All they talk about is the Syrian government is targeting hospitals, mm-hmm. which, let's see the evidence of that. Because mm-hmm. the Syrians and the Russians both say, no, we don't target hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we've been over that. But
yes.
The point is that there's a vicious war going on there. The armed opposition is very unpopular in Syria. And in Aleppo, they were unpopular right from the start when they invaded Aleppo in the summer of 2012. And even Western reporters like James Foley and Stephen Sotloff wrote about that.
Yes, yes. Well, carers really are not well known for being able to make the buses run on time or to run a school or to provide food. They're not interested in economics, these guys.
Right, and it's basically they were getting paid two or three times more than Syrian soldiers. There was a mercenary element to it. There was a religious fanaticism to it.
Mm-hmm.
The war in Syria is basically a war of aggression that's been driven by outside powers.
Yes.
If you stop the funneling of money from Saudi Arabia, Qatar, all of the support received from the USA, UK, France, Canada, and Australia, if you cut that off, the war ends in a week.
Yeah.
Because the opposition groups are basically mercenaries and fanatics, and who are being funded with money from outside, and especially now that their oil revenue has been cut off, that the Russians put that out of commission, that they were selling through Turkey,
mm-hmm.
and the son of Erdogan was actively involved in that. He owns an oil shipping line,
mm-hmm.
Obscenely enough.
Mm-hmm.
But the project is collapsing, and that's why we see the hysteria in the media, that there's a real chance now that the Syrian government can prevail, and there's a new optimism in Aleppo.
Well,
that they might, after 4 years since 2012, they might finally get peace back to their city.
Yeah, well, that's great news, and Rick Sterling, we look forward to this article. I assume it'll be available in a few days. People just go to Rick Sterling.
Yeah, hopefully tomorrow or the next day.
We will look forward to it, and thank you once again. You've been very kind.
Okay, all right. Thank you, Phil.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
It's Rick Sterling, and he does write great pieces, and you'll find him in Counterpunch. By the way, Counterpunch is running a fundraising at the moment. Please join in. It is at times like this you say, oh, boy, do we need that. I think we have maybe a little music, and we'll come back with some other news.